Welcome back to Legend in the Field podcast. We are on episode number 5, and we're just a day late from our normal scheduled podcast because we had to let our team and let everyone kind of enjoy their Labor Day. We hope you had a great Labor Day as well. And I'm very excited to introduce again and welcome back Jake Anderle. He is kind of in a new dual role within Legend Season Yield Master Solutions, and he's busy. So I'm very happy to be able to at least catch him for a few minutes and we can have a quick conversation. This week we're going to talk about what Legend Seeds calls silage first. So we call silage first and harvest second for this episode. We're crunching the numbers and the lineup and how we go through our selection process for these specific hybrids. Welcome back, Jake.
Thanks for having me. It's a little rainy and snizzly up here today, but I actually was just trying to take silage samples this morning up at Baldwin and got rained out. So,
and that's the thing. Everywhere is different across our entire footprint for Legend Seed. So it's constantly changing from day to day wherever you are. And I know you're running all over the place, but I'm glad we caught you for a little bit and we can kind of talk about our silage first products. And Legend Seeds dubs this our silage first lineup for our silage hybrids for corn. And can you kind of just, we'll just kick it right off and say, you know, explain what silage first really means and why is our team, why is Legend Seeds dedicated to those being the specific silage products that we can offer?
Yeah, so we started silage first here back, I'm shooting off the hip here, but I believe 3 to 4 years ago. And there were actually, how it started, there was two products we were looking at bringing into the lineup that just on the forage quality kind of separated themselves compared to regular dual purpose column, you know, dual purpose style hybrids where you can still take them for grain or you can take them for silage. The quality aspects on the testing side for NDFT 30 starch, you know, had super low lignin, UNDF 240 tonnage, just everything about them screamed silage, right? A lot of times when we say dual purpose to the grain guy, sometimes they get, you know, which it's not true, but they get a little stigma in their brain. Oh, it's not a grain hybrid. It says dual purpose. It must be silage. And then on the flip side, some of the dairy guys go, well, it's a dual purpose and they still take it for grain. So it's not as good. And there's a lot of hybrids in that dual purpose that are very, very solid. But you know, they work on the tonnage side, the agronomics, the grain yield, all of that's there, but we really felt we needed to have something that differentiated the products that are kind of like call them the cream of the crop. And Legend Seeds, we don't have access to any BMRs or anything like that. And actually Corteva is moving away from the BMR germplasm on the silage side. There's some other companies out there that have spins on some of these silage products. And we were just really looking at, you know, what could we bring in or what could we call something? So that's what started silage first. So what that means is there are products that were brought in that on the they're selected for in the silage lineup on their quality and tonnage characteristics. So some of them are still our top selling grain hybrids today, but they check the box over and above a quality of what a normal dual purpose hybrid is. And those two products that we brought them out in 2023. So it'd be technically, this would be our, we'd be on year four, going into year four of select stuff for that. But it was 9396 AAEZ and 9308 DEZ. Those are kind of the two products. Some of our top selling products, I know over in Wisconsin, we move a lot of 9396, especially as you go north and handles wet soils. And then, you know, Larry Croffle's areas, you head down to the west and the south. And even in Wisconsin, we sell a pile of 9308 just for the broad adaptability, the agronomics, everything about those hybrids. And then it's got the quality side to boot. So,
sure. So there's obviously the characteristics for each hybrid, whether it's, like you said, the dual purpose or it's silage specific. But like you said, some guys, gals, farmers, they all like to try to look for specific things for their areas. So when you and our selection team are looking for these hybrids to add to that silage first lineup, obviously some of them are going to be dual purpose, but majority of them, I mean, are going to be silage first, hence the name. So what characteristics specifically do you guys look at each hybrid to be like, yes, this needs to be in that lineup so that those are the first products that those customers look for?
Yeah, so the first thing is it goes, so all of these products still go through our scrutiny and our, you know, a fine tooth comb of how we bring in our grain hybrids, right? It's still the, we still look at the agronomics, root strength, stock strength, yield, disease tolerance, you name it. We look through all that, right? It has to check all those boxes before we'll essentially advance it to the table and throw it up on the wall and say, okay, this is something we need to look at. On specifically on the silage side, the metrics we're looking at is NDFD 30, starch content, sometimes starch digestibility. If the starch content isn't quite, you know, if it's flirting on the edge, sometimes we take that into account. UNDF 240 is another important one. And then obviously tonnage. If it doesn't have tonnage, it's not going to make that lineup. So that's kind of the first metric. But so the number wise, so we're looking for an NDFD 30, you know, across multiple data points that we can average at least 60. Sometimes we'll let one in there that we get in that 50 and a half, 59 range, but 60 is kind of the target we're looking for on the quality side there. Starch, we're looking for an average of 35 on starch content. And some of that, you know, when we take samples, you know, depending on the moistures and the growing season stuff, some of these are moving targets, but you can really gauge, you know, say you have something you harvest at 72 and the starch is only a 34, probably a pretty good chance that, you know, by the time it gets 67, we're going to have a 40 starch there. So, you know, that kind of gets taken into account when I sort through the data and have all that stuff pour in. But so those are kind of the metrics we're looking for on the fiber and starch. And then the UNDF 240. Especially on the dairy side, we have a lot of, especially Wisconsin wise, a lot of small frame cows. We're kind of conscious of, you know, how much is going into that diet and how much they're actually physically eating. They can only eat so much. So we need to make sure that everything that we're packing into that rumen is digested. So we're looking for a UNDF 240 of under 10. Now, the exciting thing to me is we've had a few products in the last couple of years that are approaching UNDF 240 numbers 8.5 to 9. On average, which is really, really high quality feed. So it's kind of nice to have the agronomics of a call it a grain hybrid, even though it's not a straight grain. You know, you have those agronomics of the standability, the root strength, the disease tolerances, everything you look for that sometimes we struggle with some of these silage specifics that are on the market today. And then I can bring the quality and compete with that BMR market or some of these highly digestible silages that are out there. It's kind of exciting. So
I'm just kind of throwing this one at you too as a little bit of a curveball, because there is, you know, that difference of milk per ton for dairy producers. And then there's also the beef per ton, which is the, you know, larger commercial cattle operations. And that differentiates across, you know, the entire area as well, because there's lots of different producers depending on what type of cow is eating the silage. So what do you guys look at for those two too? Because we add those, and we'll talk about the sampling protocol a little bit later here. But just kind of thinking about those factors when you're choosing these as well. Those are also tests that we look at as well too, right?
Yeah. So that all gets, so beef per ton is just a calculation of everything that I kind of talked about. So it's all goes into that same equation. It's just the beef per ton equation it's kind of like the milk per ton equation that University of Wisconsin came back out, you know, way back when milk 2006 is the equation, but kind of feeds off of that. But all of those metrics, so like fiber digestibility, starch, all of that is important on the beef side too. Now, every operation, and this is the one asterisk to all this, is every operation is different. And everybody values silage differently. So I could be on I'll use an example of a guy not too far away from where I live, limited on acres, pretty high corn silage diet. That, you know, when you start getting those high corn silage diets, every bit of fiber digestibility matters. So that's, you know, versus maybe they're not as concerned on the starch side because they'll, you know, buy corn or they'll take corn off their, you know, off some of their grain acres, put it into that ration, but they need the volume because they're limited on acres and it has to be digestible volume versus somebody that's feeding a really heavy haylage diet. You know, you get kind of from where I live in Western Wisconsin down along the river, you know, we have lots of hills, lots of alfalfa acres. You know, and alfalfa is very digestible. And if we can add that into you start adding that into ration and some of these, the low lignin alfalfa, some of this feed gets pretty hot. So those guys don't value the fiber as much. They might be valuing starch content because they don't want to buy corn or take away from the grain side of their operation. You know, they don't want to put that into that ration. So And on the beef side, you know, I've had beef guys that tell me all they care about is how many tons come through that scale and they need to put up a mountain of feed. And then I've got guys that are really looking at every metric of that in their ration. So it really is different. But the one thing we try to do in that silage first lineup is that's why we have those metrics where we have the tonnage, the agronomics, all of that stuff. And then the qualities kind of call it like a bonus for those guys that aren't looking. The flip side, the guys that are looking for that high quality can have peace of mind that we've already screened through the agronomic side. So we're not going to have anything fall out of bed that way. So, but the beef per ton equation is, and it's kind of called the down and dirty. If you ever looking at any kind of data or anything, and there isn't a beef per ton, and that's something you're looking for, the higher the milk per ton, generally the higher the beef per ton. So that's kind of, you know, you can kind of gauge what's better than what, without getting those exact numbers, but.
Sure. Good. Well, thanks for covering that. I just wanted to kind of touch on it because I know that can somewhat sometimes be a sour subject if you only look at one metric and not, and I just wanted to show that we do have those numbers in there too available. And that's why we do what we do and pick these. So specifically picking those as well. Some of the hybrids that we have are considered what you'd call leafy flowery. Some are called leafy. How do these differentiate from the silage first lineup? Because they're not necessarily included in there, but can you just, I guess, start from the beginning, explain what the difference between leafy flowery and leafy hybrids would be, and then kind of how and why they are where they are in our lineup?
Yep. So leafies and leafy floweries came out back in about 2014, 15, somewhere in there. So they're kind of unique germplasm to the marketplace. So they are silage specific. So you do have to chop them every year. Inevitably, a guy has 10, 20 acres left over and he goes, can I combine it? I don't need it. And it really, they do not combine well. They're not bred for grain dry down. They're not bred for test weight. They're not bred for combinability, if that's a word. they kind of turn into a train wreck when you go that way. So they are meant for corn silage. Flip side, the silage first are truly by definition a dual purpose hybrid. So I can tell you one that's in our lineup today is PB9101 Smart Stack. That's one that comes through our lineup, which I'll talk about our testing protocol and why that's so important to us. But that is one of our top selling grain hybrids today in the rootworm market from South Dakota to Michigan. So we sell a lot of the conventional and the VT2 version of that as well. But you know, it works on the grain side and it is still one of our top producers on the silage. And it honestly is the benchmark in the silage first lineup is what we're looking for, that quality. You kind of put that one up on a pedestal. So don't think that these hybrids are, you know, they're only, you know, like Jake said, they're silage, so I can only chop them. It's not the case. The leafies and the leafy floweries have to be chopped. So those plants are all about low population, led their full flex hybrids. The leafies have a gene. They're called the leafy gene. So they'll put anywhere from 10 to 14 leaves above the ear. We like them at ideally less than 30,000 plants of the acre. And some guys, they get crazy when they see a 2 in the planting population in the front. But I personally like them at 28,000 or below. They will do every bit of tonnage at 28,000 that they will do at 32. The agronomics that those plants need to have that low pop to thrive. They're bred and they like room. They like flex. Those ears will flex out to 52, 54 long. We just need to give them the space they need. So there's the leafy camp. And then the leafy floweries have all of that same stuff I just described with the low pop, that big flex ear, all the leaves. The difference is a quarter of the kernels, and when they make that male-female cross, it's a flowery hybrid by a leafy hybrid. A quarter of those kernels on that ear end up being a flowery kind of a very light test weight starch. So they're a little bit more digestible on the starch side. So when you take a normal feed sample and you send an NIR on a leafy flowery, a lot of times they look like they're very low in starch. And guys will be like, you told me this is going to be the best silage ever. But the key is that the NIR will miss about a quarter of the starch content that's there because that NIR test was developed in the 70s. And what it does is it measures the yellow wavelength of light. So when that test goes in, it's measuring that the reflectiveness back and measures starch. the light kind of flowery starch, if you will, is a very light kind of pale color, yellow, white. And so it doesn't quite pick that up on a test. So it actually can measure it as ash. It can just measure it as undigestible fiber. So it does mess with that a little bit. But the leafy floweries kind of have a little bit more of a play on the dairy side, especially guys that are feeding the what I call the lower corn silage diets. That digestible starch in there really is a big play for them. Where the leafy floweries and even the leafies on the dairy side, where they kind of have a little bit of a hang up is the fiber digestibilities really struggle to get above 58, 59. For most guys, that's more than adequate. But when you really start getting guys that are really looking at the high metrics on feed, and we're shooting for that 60, 62, 64 NDFD 30, no matter how low we drop the pops on the leafies, it just can't quite get there. Sure. Now, flip side, on the beef side, leafies and leafy floweries are phenomenal products, you know, and digestibility matters on the beef side, but guys usually aren't as, you know, adamant that that's a big thing. They'll trade to 5-6 more tons, which most producers would gladly do that. Less acres to chop, less, you know, chopping bill, that kind of thing. So, and as especially as we move less, as we move west in the Legend footprint, out to Dakota, West Minnesota, you start getting feedlot acres. That's when those leafies and leafy flowers, and even down, you get into Larry Croffle's area as far west as he goes, those leafies really become a big play. A lot of those areas we're planting at lower populations anyway. So it checks that box. Some of the hybrids really seem to handle drought stress really well as we move them west, where we can really drop pops back and still gain good tonnage. So the leafies and leafy flowers, they do have a place on the dairy side, but they're mainly, I would call them a feedlot beef or guys that just care about pure tons. Maybe we're selling, you know, there's a market out there for guys selling silage too, to some of these farms. If you're just getting paid on tonnage, they're great products to look at. So.
Sure. So it's starting too. Silage is starting. Silage harvest has begun. You have gone out and now started to do some of the testing on some of our products, but for the actual silage harvest in your area, or I guess for the majority of the area, how does that affect the rest of the harvest schedule? Because grain farmers like myself, that we don't cut any silage anymore around here on our operation, but we're getting to the point of what time are we going to have to start? When do we need to bring the equipment in, start getting stuff ready for the grain harvest? But how does the silage harvest affect the rest of the harvest schedule for everyone?
Yeah, I mean, the schedule timing, I mean, everybody's got to fit their own thing in, because it's unfortunately this year, the way things look in a lot of Wisconsin locally where I live, some silage harvest is going to run into right into the first of soybean harvest. And in most years on the, at least in Wisconsin, Minnesota, parts of Iowa, we're running into fourth crop hay being a problem, you know, getting that drop in the hay, you know, the hay head and trying to get our Kemper head on and get the kernel processor put in. And guys are always stressed at that time because the corn's getting too dry. Now this year's kind of the opposite. We're going to run in silage seems to be like it's going to be a touch later than it has the last 2 years, but and a lot of guys are panicking, and I just was on the phone with a few guys this morning. This is normal. We've been pretty blessed on the, you know, granted there was some yield losses because all the heat and the drought we've had, but we've had two really early harvests across the upper Midwest. You know, and so guys kind of forget that, you know, silage timing, you know, we always say it in Wisconsin, you know, around Labor Day weekend, maybe a little after. Well, Labor Day was physically the earliest it could be this year too. So, but in terms of, you know, how does it affect it? That's the one thing is guys are kind of, they're looking at their corn right now and they're saying, I don't think it's going to be another 3 weeks. It's going to be another month. And I guess I'm going to, you know, maybe go off a little tangent here, but corn silage is a lot drier right now, especially if you have areas that there's leaf disease than it looks. So it's kind of, that's one thing is you don't want to get caught behind the eight ball of getting your combine ready. And now I'll wait another week. We're going to work on the combine, really make sure you're out there checking that stuff on the, and that'll help you set up getting prepped for the other parts of harvest. Cause you don't want to get caught in the shop an extra week and have your silage get too dry on you. So
right. One of the things that we, and you are very passionate about is the silage protocol. We talked about a little bit ago that we were going to touch on this, but We went through, we have an entire silage sampling protocol that our agronomy team goes through to make sure that each step is correct in the process of making sure that we get the most accurate information out of our silage samples. So can you just kind of go through that protocol, super high level, but tell us also why, like, what is the importance of doing that and doing it so specifically down to, you know, keeping it, letting it ferment for as long as it does, just kind of touch on some of the things that we do as our agronomy team to get those samples.
Yeah. Yep. So this has kind of been the protocol for the last, since we started silage first. But okay, so I guess on the harvest side with our protocol and everything, it's one thing we started probably a good, I'm going to say 3 to 4 years ago now, back when we started silage first. But it all goes back to January, February when we do our plot seed planning for our plots. So we do have silage plots that we intend to take for silage harvest. Those are kind of separate from our grain plots, but we also do a lot of harvesting, especially our EXPs, brand new products. We'll actually go into grain plots, and it seems kind of almost sacrilegious, but it's perfectly fine because those products, nobody says that you can't chop them through a wood chipper. But we actually will go into our grain plots, especially specific sites where we have a lot of different maturities or a lot of new stuff that we're looking at, even trying to get a variability of soil type so it's not all on perfect ground, because there's not a single farm out there that has all perfect ground everywhere. And we try to get as many data points from as many diverse locations as we can. Especially we hammer heavy on the new stuff and all the XPs as our main focus there. And so what we do, the protocol, so we're waiting ideally for optimal plant moisture. 68% is what we're shooting for. The agronomists here, we do our best to get stuff harvested. This year, I think we're going to have very, very good data just overall. Last year, no matter how fast we could drive or how many hotels we could try to stay in, it was almost impossible to try to stay on stuff with all those 80-degree days, 20-mile-an-hour winds. Some plots got a little drier than we wanted, but that's just kind of, that's reality of it, right? That's the way farming was last year. So, but what we do is we go into the plot, you walk in at least 20 to 30 feet, get to where everything is a representative level, right? We don't have any, you know, these three hybrids have a horrible nitrogen deficiency up front, or there's, you know, missing plants here because the planter stopped working. We're looking for, you know, normal levels. We're not cherry picking. And then what we do is we go through and we're picking 12 plants out of each entry that we want to sample. So what we're looking for is, you know, we can't control the planters that are being used or anything like that. So what we do is we pick 12 representative plants from that entry. And if you've ever planted a plot or ever want to switch seed sizes, every planter is different. Sometimes a planter will plant medium flats at 38,000, and then you go to large rounds, it'll be at 32,000. Well, we don't want to take stand counts and say, yep, this one's at 38 and this one's at 32. The 38,000, it might affect the quality negative, but it's going to, you know, positively affect the tonnage, and that throws data off. So what we're looking for is that, you know, we put in what the plot is planted at for the tonnage. That way it doesn't give anything an advantage or disadvantage. And really the tonnage is a decent metric. I mean, that's obviously very important, but for hand sampling, even if we rip 17 feet, 5 inches, it's really hard to get a representative tonnage number. So it just gives us a ballpark of, you know, plus or minus a ton accuracy there. Sure. Then when we go to chip them, so we weigh the 12 plants, record that down. And then we pick three out of that, of those 12 that are representative average type plants. Chip those, mix them up in a bin or a bucket or whatever, get a good mix, and then send in about a gallon bag size, or, you know, probably a couple pounds of silage. And what we actually do, it's a little different. We don't send them in fresh. We actually go in and we vacuum seal them and let them ferment for 30 days. Why that's important and kind of why I feel that's the better method, we could send them in an IR and turn around our data really fast and get it out to the country. The thing is, though, is how things test NIR, good or bad, can change depending on if it's fermented or not. So I've had samples that you test them, you know, you test it, you know, when it comes off the field, and all of a sudden you ferment it, and we pick up 350 pounds of milk per ton. The other thing is for the end user, the customer side, on the farm, is they don't get paid and their milk production isn't off of when it gets green chopped in the field. They get paid off of what it is in that pile. And so, you know, obviously we're a seed company. We need to sell seed and we can't hold that data till, you know, next March when it's ready to feed. So we let it ferment for 30 days and we take it into Dairyland Labs and have a complete analysis ran there. We use the St. Cloud location in Arcadia. Everything is the same lab. That way the data is consistent, same machines. So we don't get a lot of variability from test to test or like from lab to lab. Surprisingly, surprisingly, there is between labs. If you send samples and there's some labs are, you know, not calling stack in the deck, but some labs, you know, test much higher for starch and they're less on fiber and flip flop vice versa. If you send in a sample to one lab, then send another to another, it just completely skews the data to the point, you know, everything has got to be consistent on that side. Yep. So,
right. As it begins, because this is like, this is just the amp up time right now of you're kind of getting ready. When you're going out and looking at your fields, seeing if it's ready, seeing, you know, if the timing is right, what are all the factors? So we've had a growing season. We've had quite a bit of rain across the area. There has been some places of drought, but there's certain factors that affect harvest every single year. So what, in your opinion, have you seen as those factors affecting the 2025 growing season and then into the harvest?
Yeah, so looking at it this year, one thing that is going to, and I could be in South Dakota, I could be in Northern Iowa, I could be in Eastern Wisconsin. The number one factor that's influencing silage moistures is leaf and stalk disease. Pick your poison, no matter, and I could walk in just about any field in the United States this year, I think, and find some form of disease out there. It's just, we've had conducive conditions with the weather patterns, hot and humid in July and early August, a lot of rain on the front side. Now we've kind of cooled down and moderated, but we're still getting wet canopies. So the two factors, especially this year, is tar spot and southern rust. I took two locations, Elkader, Iowa, and Galesville, Wisconsin, on Friday for silage sampling. Elkader was, I think it's actually funny, the last 4 years I've taken that plot off on August 29th, and it has been optimal every single time. Galesville for planting date was much earlier than anticipated. Just driving by doing the 60 mile an hour test, you would have told me it was all 75 to 80% moisture. And, you know, Jake, you're crazy. Why are you down here taking silage sampling? Some of those were only quarter to even just barely touching half milk line. But the overall plant moistures, when we vacuum seal samples, obviously I don't know the moistures till 30 days after harvest when I take it in. Generally though, if it's over 70%, when I vacuum seal, it'll juice, just like in a pile. If you got 72% corn silage and you're putting her in a bunker, or even a bagger, you're going to have the Green River running, you know, and it's that same concept. But I didn't have a single sample juice from our Gales location. That area of Wisconsin has been just inundated with southern rust, to the point where those leaves are dying. So you can't always go, obviously we're looking for half milk line is kind of a lot of guys' trigger. You know, if you're putting in an upright silo, you know, maybe it's a little drier. Some guys put in a pile, they like it at 70, maybe they're doing a little wetter, but generally that's kind of the ballpark. I will say, if you've got fields, especially that were not sprayed to the fungicide, that you know you're having leaf disease issues, and now I would almost be checking it every 2 to 3 days for moisture. Because it is
that fast.
Yes, those, as these leaf diseases, you know, I'm sitting here today and I'm staring at a big rain cloud coming, and we're going to head into some 50s and very low 60s for temps with very wet canopies. Corn's not growing, but guess what is? Disease. And that's disease. We're going to start seeing stuff dry down. As you head down into northern Iowa, there's actually a fair amount, you can pick it out from the road, of anthracnose top dieback. You know, and some of those guys, you know, they're already starting to roll pretty heavy, on corn silage, but that's another one that's coming. Crown rot can really dramatically dry things down when that root crown rots out and cannibalizes to fill that ear, especially where we've had wet conditions and we've had low nitrogen, or where we've been deficient in nitrogen for a while. Some of those hybrids are going to cannibalize themselves to try to fill that ear. And that, when that happens and it, you know, you eat that internal pith out, that silage can drop a point and a half a day if we get the right weather conditions. So it's this year, I would say that the one factor is disease. Another one, it's kind of mainly for the upper Midwest, planting date. Things that I'm seeing just out in the field, if it was planted before May 8th, 9th, 10th, that stuff is going to be, no matter the maturity or where we're at, if it was planted before that on worked ground, you're probably going to be heading into silage, I'd say, within the next week if you're not already starting. Looking, if we had a big cold rain that kind of hit a lot of the upper Midwest, it was May 19th, 18th, I believe, we had a 40 to 42 degree rain event hit Minnesota, Wisconsin, even over into Michigan. That rain event, if you were planted after that, which is still plenty of time, you know, to get corn to GDUs, it seems like it's amplified at being behind because we were cold for 3 weeks after that, where we barely broke 60 most days. So yeah, we really haven't had a lot of GDUs on that corn. Those are the fields that I think are going to be average to behind when we look at silage harvest timing. So those fields are looking more like the end of September, that 20-25th time frame. So,
will any of those, does any of these disease pressures cause any issues after cutting?
Once yes.
it goes into a pile, once
yep,
it goes
that's
into
a silo? Very good question. So there's, and I don't have any concrete data or evidence or anything of how much incidence leads to whatever, but so tar spot's a big one that can deal, you can run into mycotoxin or vomitoxin issues in the pile. Anytime you get leaf disease in there, that tissue dies prematurely, especially like with southern rust. Well, when a plant dies or a leaf just kills itself off, there's still a lot of sugar in that leaf tissue, more than there should be. And the lid's sure. not as lignified. So, and you've got all that. And some of those leaves, if you actually walk out there, I've seen this, there's actually kind of a pink mold that's starting to grow on some of this southern rust that's been in there a long time, these leaves that have died. What happens when you chop that and that goes into a pile is then all of a sudden you start getting these hot spots. And if anybody's ever had a, you know, raised feed for more than 5-6 years, they've seen this. You get these little blue spots or pink spots, and that can lead to cattle health issues, whether it be on the beef or the dairy side. Especially on the dairy side, you start having to put binders, you know, in to make feed essentially work again, you know, so we're not making cattle sick. And it gets very, very expensive very fast. So that's where I would say this year, more than any year, the one thing that would have paid, you know, we can only look back and say, oh, I wish I would have done this. But fungicide, fungicide at R1 to R2 corn would have paid tremendously on corn silage this year. And it's, now next year could be completely different, you know, and everybody has their arguments or their beliefs on that. But for forage quality, especially on these leaf diseases, and then also on the tonnage, you know, if we're losing grain yield, we're losing tonnage. And if we're losing grain yield, we're losing quality. And so it just kind of is a step-by-step, you know, kind of hits you that way. But fungicides on corn silage, 90% of the time are going to give you a good return on investment. So.
Okay, good. Well, just as a recap too, I mean, a lot of the products that are chosen on our Silage First, you can check those out on our website at legendseeds.net, or get a hold of your local agronomist or account manager, and you can see firsthand in our new product guide for 2026 what those products are. Otherwise, just contact your agronomist and have those conversations, seeing how, you know, what factors you're seeing out in your fields and the questions that you have. Otherwise, you're busy, Jake, so I'm not going to direct them directly to you, but any of our Legend account managers or our agronomists specifically can answer those questions for you. But thank you so much for joining us, Jake. I know you're busy. I want to get you back on the road, but we'll bring you back again, because you are the one that knows these products and you know our process so well. So thank you again for joining us. And be safe out there.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. And I guess people can contact me. Don't be afraid to call me. But if I don't answer, text me and I'll call you right back. But so
perfect. Well, thank you for joining us. And we'll be seeing you out in the field or on the next episode of Legend in the Field podcast.